of ways. You know, the trauma of Trump being elected has kind of brought people out who want to do something, who want to get involved. So I think, you know, we've seen that at Labor Notes, and we want to really fan the flames and keep people feeling hopeful. But the more we can bring people together talking about taking action, whether they're in a union that is, you know, fighting hard and very active, or whether they're in a union that's kind of stuck in old way of doing things that's more conservative or inactive, I think people can make a lot of change by working together in their workplace, by, you know, building out from there. So I think you can also support Labor Notes. We're in our spring fundraising drive, so labornotes.org. Check out, we've got a promotion of a 40th anniversary T-shirt that you get if you donate. And, you know, supporting Labor Notes helps bring low-wage workers to conferences and to events. But I think that mostly we just want to empower workers to start working on this themselves. So they can come to Labor Notes events, and they can also get involved in their own organizations.
So now I'm going to get our historian, Nelson. Okay, I want you to conjure up one of the best flyers that you saw from May Day of old, which maybe we should send to Biden and good God, the rest of them, and take us out with one of the great sentiments of one of those fine May Day flyers, pamphlets, leaflets from the height of our organizing drives when, as Ken would say, we did have the labor movement and movement in the labor movement.
Well, the leaflet I now remember, and it's not.
I knew you would.
No, it was Frederick Douglass wrote it. It was right in the middle of the Civil War, and it was "Men of Color to Arms." Big poster. He was recruiting for the Union Army, and it was a revolutionary. It was a revolutionary poster. I mean, it was arming the those who had been oppressed. And what we need, you know, is a poster to arms. That is the, I mean, it's metaphorical, and it has reality to it as well. And I think there is a revolutionary spirit which is there, and we need to construct channels through which it can manifest itself. And I think that this is possible, and we see glimpses of it. So that's I'm not discouraged this season. I'm actually quite encouraged, and I think that the union movement it can have a tremendous resurgence. The institutional form it will take will not be the same as the old, but it can be there.
Oh, Nelson, I love it. I love that, and Samantha. So we've got the melding. We've got the wonderful professorial historian, activist in so many ways, Nelson Lichtenstein, who, you should look up his books. They're really important. He is a professor of history at the University of California, Santa Barbara, and the wonderful, and he applauds Labor Notes, as do we, and Samantha Winslow, staff writer and organizer and co-director of Labor Notes, applauds him as well she should. We give and pay homage to our elders in the best sense, who have brought us so much of the vibrancy of the past to inform the future on this May Day, the International Working People's Day. Love both of you, and we want to see a hell of a lot more troublemaker schools, and we want to see a hell of a lot more of us being troublemakers, tilting against the status quo to build workers' power, because workers of the world unite.
You have nothing to lose but your change, and you have a world to win.
And with people on our side like Nelson Lichtenstein and Samantha Winslow, we will make it so. Thank you both. Good May Day.
Bye-bye.
Thanks so much. Happy May Day.
Thank you.
We have plowed have planted, we have gathered into barns, done the same work as the men with babies in our arms. But you won't find our stories in most history books you read. We were there, we're still here, fighting for the things we need. We were there in the factory. We were there in the mills. We were there in the mines and came home to fix.
Tell it, Bev Grant. We were there. We were there. We were there. We are there. Novelist and community historian Ellie Bielow gave me a wonderful read last night with High Voltage Women, Breaking Barriers at Seattle Light. Telling the story of 10 women electrical trade trainees and their fight against intense, long-running discrimination at Seattle's public utility. Now, the book is a riveting account of what it's like for women and people of color breaking into a segregated workforce. Their strength, their dignity, their growing confidence radiate through. They are my sheroes because we were there, and that is every bit a part of our May Day.
And then we'll hear from Megan Cornish with her gripping story of a multiracial group of women who put their bodies on the line to gain a foothold in the male and largely white electrical trades at Seattle's publicly owned utility in the 1970s, and how these women implemented affirmative action in the face of life-threatening sexism and racism, because we were there.
Indeed, yes, we were there. Ellie, thank you for being with us.
Thank you, Mimi.
Let's talk about this gripping story of this multiracial group of women who put their bodies on the line to gain a foothold in the male and largely white electrical trades at Seattle's public-owned utility, and this was in the 1970s. This was a kind of affirmative action in the face of really life-threatening sexism and racism. So I don't know if you want to start particularly with the story of maybe Clara Frazier. Why don't we? Because let's put a personal face on it.
So Clara Frazier was a longtime activist in the Seattle community who had come up under HUD, taking on and incorporating affirmative action through a number of programs in Seattle. And Seattle as a city was under the gun in the early 70s because of its own racism. In particular, sexism was charged later, but they were under federal court mandates to start stepping up affirmative action programs in order to get federal funding for infrastructure. So the City Light, which is a publicly owned utility, hired this activist thinking that she would kind of go in her corner and come up with something fairly innocuous as a program to bring women into the electrical trade. Anyone who knew Clara Frazier knew she was not going to stay in the corner, and she didn't. So she designed this program facing ever-mounting opposition. The more she stepped up, the more the administrators of the utility were sorry they had hired her and started to look at ways to fire her. But she did create this program for 10 women to break into the electrical trades at this publicly owned utility.
But the coming together of feminist issues, of civil rights issues and labor issues, all of that really came together in trying to create this program and these really heroic women.
It did indeed. When this program was initiated, over 300 women, and this is in the early 70s, applied for the opportunity to be in this program. And these are line workers. These are the people who work with high voltage lines, go up the power poles and deal with whatever is mounted on them, the equipment. And this was the first opening for women to try this program. So 300 women applied, 10 women were chosen, and in every way it was mixed racially in terms of there was one Asian woman, two black women, one Chicana. It was mixed in terms of gender identification, gay and straight. It was mixed in terms of economic class in the sense of all the women were poor at the time, but some had more education and opportunities than others. Then the program fell apart almost before it started in terms of what it had promised. So these women were put out to begin work before they'd gotten their first paycheck. So they didn't even have money, some of them, to buy the work clothes that were required for the job. That was the start of it. And the administration, as I said, all white, all male at the top level, did not
see this coming. They had thought they would be able to kind of placate liberal Seattle with the program, not with the actual women. They hadn't really thought what was going to be like when they actually had women on the work site.
Well, to get back to Clara Fraser, right? So here's this woman,
right.
You know, and there were groups like Freedom Socialist Party and so on. I mean, this was a real political onslaught that, again, really brought together the issues of discrimination and civil rights and labor rights and so on, and gender, of course. The issue of the things that Fraser, let's go a little deeper into it. She really, from my reading, God, did she face the wrath of management. And I want you to talk a little bit more about how that actually happened. She went on to sue the city for discrimination on the basis of sex and political ideology, which is all part of this extraordinary story and this phenomenal book, High Voltage Women, Breaking Barriers at Seattle City Light.
She actually, and the 10 ETTs, or what they call the trainees, they also brought a claim for sex discrimination, it was called at the time. Now, Clara Fraser, they were after her from the beginning, as I said, as she designed the program, and then as she tried to carry it out. And it was insidious administrative kind of harassment for her, which is why she added the political harassment. She was a known activist, but that didn't stop them from pursuing her. And so they charged her with things she hadn't done in terms of her actual work. They took her off the program as soon as the women came on and were actually in the field. They transferred her off the program so that they had the trainees had no administrative support. So Clara Fraser was a member of the Radical Women, and so were three of the women who were chosen to be in the trainees. So they led the political charge on challenging the city and the city-owned utility, both in court and on the work site. And I have to say that the 10 women were not in total solidarity in the sense of they were not all political activists. They were activists in the sense that they wanted the same kind of pay and the same kind of treatment on the work site as the men who had the jobs.
And I want to get into, and again, I'm glad that you mentioned that there were members of Radical Women and the Freedom Socialist Party, because this is the kind of thing that when you talk about being a socialist, or what is a socialist, these kind of programs and these kind of things and living it are what we who consider ourselves to be socialist should be advocating. Now, having said that, talk about Heidi Durham, who was another one of the trainees, and the kind of job harassment that she failed, because we really have to understand what these women did. And while some were and others may not have been quote unquote self-consciously political, their actions were thoroughly political and bucked a racist, a system of gender bias to really open up opportunities, which still have not been, the door has not fully been kicked in yet, and we still need to do the kicking. But talk about Heidi Durham and her role in all of this and what she faced as one of the trainees.
Heidi Durham was the youngest of the 10 women that came in on this program. She was 21 when she came on. She was a member of the Radical Women and the Freedom Socialist Party at that time. She came on ready to work. They all faced quite a bit of discrimination as they were being trained. Heidi continued on and got herself into the, after much legal maneuvering, was finally allowed to move into training as an apprentice for a line worker. This is the pole work and the high voltage. On the job, she was harassed. She was given work reports and evaluations by one job site leader in particular that were untrue and put greater pressure on her. So on a particular day, she was told to climb these poles up and down with the spikes on her feet and keep up with two guys in a bucket truck, which is a lift truck with a bucket. So she was supposed to be running up and down these poles as fast as these two experienced guys in a bucket truck. So she kept up. She was doing it. She went up. She was coming down. One of the spikes hit a knot in the wood and did not bite in. The other one was not fully engaged, and she fell some 30 to 40 feet and broke her back, life-threatening injury. This is at age 22. She eventually managed to get herself back, but in the interim, in addition to this fall that I think was based on harassment, one of her co-workers, Megan Cornish, was out on a crew. They heard on their truck radio that there was something that had gone on. Someone had been hurt. They went and called in to find out who it was. They found out it was Heidi. and a coworker of Magon's turned to her and said, "Oh, too bad, your friend fall down, go boom, boom." So Heidi was crippled for life from this injury and never went back to the line worker apprenticeship, but eventually through legal pressure was hired back on City Light and became basically managed power at a desk job.
And of course, what Heidi also did, not even daunted by this terrifying, life-crippling injury, this socialist woman participated in their local, the IBEW Local 77, and they pushed it forward. And I want you to talk about that, too. So it was management, it was male dominance and misogyny, etc., that harassed, but it was also their efforts to educate their unions.
Yeah, and there was a lot of educating to be done. It was IBEW, the Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, Local 77, and at the beginning, the union keys from the beginning of the program were their own unit within the local, which was brilliant. But the local didn't really want them for quite a while until the harassment became so obvious. They were given this letter, a loyalty oath letter, while in training saying, if you don't sign this letter, you're gone. And the letter says, I will either cooperate with whatever the utility comes up with for a program or I'll quit right now. And finally, the local said, don't sign that letter. Put this qualifier on the bottom and sign over to the side. That was the first time IBEW stepped up, the 77 stepped up over time. But when Heidi's injury happened, the first report that went through the union, the accident report, the union signed off on one saying that it was her own fault for not being a good worker, but by the end, they actually gave these buttons to the women who survived this whole program. The local honored with a plaque and buttons, radical social bitches is what the button said. And men and women in the local proudly wore those buttons and still do.
You know, really bravo for this story. And I love the way you describe yourself. You're a novelist and you're a community historian, because that makes the history a living reality. And having said that, this book is a story about the past, but it's the present and the future. And how do you view that as well?
I view that, and as you said, the reason I call myself a community historian is because I'm interested in the interaction of people who identify and work together towards something for at least a period of time. I think, as a woman, I am sorry I can not say this is a Cinderella tale and everything turned out fine and the numbers are all different and everybody's happy at Seattle City Light. There's new actions being taken about discrimination at City Light to this day, and we're talking almost 50 years later. However, there is a change on the work site, and I think it's interesting within the union community, especially the trades, there is a shift, and I think it has to do with the first women coming in and the first people of color coming in, where for the first time, the so-called FBI of the unions, fathers, brothers, and in-laws, has started to recognize that women and people of color, oh, that's like my daughter. Oh, that's like the person my kids know. So, and in actually working with people different than themselves, I think the union movement has begun, the traditional union movement, begun to understand that it is all of us and not just the FBI, the fathers, brothers, and in-laws. So I view that as a major, major step forward.
Now, this book is an absolute handbook for political savvy organizing. It's an also inspiring testament, really, to the tenacity and bravery and pure grit of the trainees who stood their ground, did their jobs, and made history. And you're coming into town, right?
I am not. Megan Cornish, one of the actual trainees, is coming into town.
Megan Cornish, one of the City Light groundbreaker workers, one of our sheroes, to get a broader view of what real sheroes are. Just the ordinary sisters who have made waves and broke ground from the grassroots. And read High Voltage Women, Breaking Barriers at Seattle City Light. My dear sister Ellie Ballou is a great, great novelist and a great community historian and melds the two. Thank you, my dear sister.
I want to thank Ellie Ballou for her masterful capturing of the history of this groundbreaking electrical trades trainee program for women at Seattle City Light. She brought it to life by doing a terrific job of reaching out and interviewing so many of the participants in this struggle. And she also mastered the extensive documentation of that fight. I also want to give a bit of tribute to those who most made the success of the Electrical Trades Trainee Program possible. First, of course, Clara Fraser, who founded socialist feminism as a distinct political theory, as well as two organizations to put that theory into practice, which you've heard about, Freedom Socialist Party and Radical Women. She was also a trainer and an employment expert with the federal anti-poverty program that existed for a few years during the Johnson years. From the start, management knew she was a Marxist and a civil rights militant. They needed those skills to make the program successful. Then I want to hail Heidi Durham. Heidi, as a line worker apprentice, suffered the fall from a pole that broke her back. Her indomitable spirit and leadership started with her refusal to let that accident crush her. Her fight within the union not to be scapegoated for her own accident, and her fight to force management to keep her in the trade. They wanted to make her a secretary, believe it or not, after all that. She went on to become a leader and community organizer who spearheaded many of the ETT fights, not only for our rights, but against ongoing discrimination toward many at the utility, to expand affirmative action hiring of people of color and women, and especially women of color who are the most left out, even under affirmative action. She fought for fair employment and open housing in Seattle ordinances, and it was Heidi's untimely death in 2015 that led many people to contribute to the publication fund for this book and to FSP's determination to see this vital story told. I also want to salute Daisy Jones, one of the two black women ETTs, who was the first leader of our group, but was forced out after the first year when we were told that we would be laid off. As a mother with several children, she couldn't wait to be laid off. She had to go find a job. Because of being forced to quit, she was by law dropped from the affirmative action case to get her job back. And that's another example of how systemic racism operates in this society. I want to salute Terry Bach, who was the first female journey level line worker at City Light and the only woman ETT to become one. And her 6-year battle to achieve that was unrelenting. Then she turned around and became the first journey level cable splicer. And finally, I want to salute Letha Neal, the other black woman ETT, who had the hardest fight to be recognized in her trade and was the last to reach journey level, becoming a cable splicer after many years of perseverance in the trade. And here I have to take a little detour, because the success of the program is really striking. Even though City Light management turned totally against us within our first 2 weeks on the job and effectively fired 8 of the 10 women after a little over a year, with the help of our successful discrimination suit, only 2 of the 10 women left the trade, and one of them switched to another trade, becoming a bus driver, and that was Daisy. All 8 of the rest reached journey level or higher jobs at City Light, and 7 had full 30-year careers at the utility.
Wow.
Even though the ETT program was never restarted, constant pressure from us to continue affirmative action hiring did raise the numbers of women and men of color at City Light and in Seattle generally for many years. So what, you may ask, made this level of success of the program possible? This book is unique in that it tells the whole gripping story. The secret was in the synergy of 2 elements that added up to be greater than the sum of their parts. One was a community of fighters, starting with the men of color who came before us as electrical trades trainees, the ones who made it through the gauntlet, I have to say, and then the multiracial group of 10 women trainees with 4 women of color, but going on to embrace a whole community of people passionate about doing the right thing. This included courageous white male coworkers who had to stand up to intense peer pressure, women employees outside the trades, and a whole wider Seattle community that supported us in action. The other thing that is fairly unique is that the book tells about the role that political radicals played in the success of the fight. It's so unusual, both because radicals are often excluded from the get-go, and also because when they are there, their role is usually hidden. This role was initially, of course, from the program's architect, Claire Fraser, who was a longtime labor organizer and affirmative action employment pioneer already. She learned her skills in the Trotskyist movement that also aspires to transform society. So we don't have to keep fighting these fights over and over again, please? She knew how to organize a fight to win, and was always generous in teaching those skills far and wide. It was these two things, people who were fighters, hooking up with people eager to teach the skills of fighting effectively, that built the battle royale that this book is about. I want to tell you something of the structure of the book so you can see what an amazing achievement it is. It opens with the background of the period of the 70s, how it was impacted by the civil rights movement of the 50s and 60s, which won affirmative action hiring, which was implemented in federal contracts, federal and later local public employment, and college admissions. This was not some kind of special treatment, as its opponents claim. That would be the corrupt bribes for college for the rich that was just exposed in the media. Affirmative action was the recognition that those who have been systematically excluded need to be given the same chances that the more privileged have always had. After years of right-wing attack, this fight needs to be waged again because the doors of opportunity have been slammed shut almost as tightly as they were in the 50s. Ellie goes on to eloquently explain how the ETT program came about, how it was structured to succeed, when so many programs of the time had limited success. The rest of the book details the fight from the competitive ETT hiring process to the Wildcat 11-day strike by virtually the entire City Light workforce only the month before we came on the job, to our first days at work when we took the side of the rebellious employees, enraging the superintendent, to management's continuous attacks on the group and on Clara. It details the discrimination cases of the ETTs and Clara, and our victories and return to work. The ETTs in only a year, and Clara after a very long 7 years. It tells a little bit about the continuing organizing against discrimination and harassment in the 80s and 90s with the Committee for Equal Rights for City Light, and today with a new group founded in 2017, the Seattle Silence Breakers, which includes tradeswomen and also women and some men throughout city employment, fight not only sexual harassment, but race and sex and LGBTQ discrimination in city employment. And there are so many stories that Ellie tells from so many people's experiences. Here are just a few. Heidi's as an apprentice on the crew that pitted her, climbing up and down each pole with hooks on her legs, against 2 journeymen using a bucket truck and racing her to install streetlights on opposite sides of the road. She was literally running up and down the poles when one of her hooks hit a knot and kicked out, causing her to fall 23 feet. But then, immediately after word of this appalling accident went out to the crews, a lineman on my crew mocked Heidi and me, saying, "I hear your friend fall down, go boom. Yeah. There was ETT Jody Olvera having a coworker wait till she was standing in the back of a parked truck with the back door open, gun the engine, then slam on the brakes in an effort to make her fall out. But there are good stories, too. When Daisy Jones was being harassed with racist taunts, waiting till the whole crew was in the truck to lock them in. It was a hot day, too, by the way. Promising they wouldn't get out until they apologized and pledged to stop permanently. Needless to say, they got manners rapidly. The black tradesmen and other men of color who were essential early comrades in arms and who were literally our lifeline for survival. My black neighbor was a helper, gave me rides to work when we were assigned to the same service center. So I didn't feel isolated going into work those early days. Most importantly, it was mainly these men who were willing to give us the essential training we needed to be able to learn our jobs. And as you guys know, that's the key thing, people who actually teach you, right? It was black lineman John Harris who kept a later line apprentice, Sherry Holmes, from being thrown off a pole by a white lineman who didn't like her smart mouth. And there was Angel Arrowsmith's famous retort to a guy who was berating her as a very out lesbian. I'm more of a woman than you'll ever have and more of a man than you'll ever be. My personal stories include how I was outed as a Radical Women member on my first week on the cruise. We heard you are a member of Radical Women. Gasp. You're a women's liber? I think they missed the fact that I was a socialist. That was nearly as important as being a feminist. An attempted frame-up by management of me and two other ETTs, Terry Bach and Jody Olvera, on manufactured charges of drinking on the job. That didn't get too far because, since it wasn't true, they didn't have any evidence. But they still managed to give Terry 3 days without pay for insubordination. Then there was the Radical Socialist Bitches label applied to the Radical Women members, Heidi, Terry, me, and Kathleen Merrigan, who was one of the second wave of women hires, by the IBEW union rep for City Light. When we heard of it, we turned the tables on him, embracing it, making RSB buttons, and wearing them to the next union meeting, offering them to our union brothers and their wives and daughters. They were a great hit. When the three former ETTs retired, the union gave us plaques of appreciation to their very own RSVs. And not least for me was becoming a power dispatcher with equal responsibility as my male co-workers over the electrical system and the work of the crews on it. The theme running through most of these stories is that we didn't sue our coworkers individually for their discriminatory behavior if we could help it. We confronted them directly and enlisted other coworkers and our union to support us. Legally, we held management responsible for creating a biased work environment. If they didn't promote and reward discrimination, it would stop tomorrow. Never forget that. The most rewarding part of this history for me was joining with others to fight for affirmative action, yes. Safety on the job, it's often the women and the people of color who are the ones saying that because they know that their lives are the most on the line. And overall workers' rights, which are always all wrapped up together in my experience. If you have a divided workforce, you have a weak workforce. These experiences has taught me is that it's always a good thing, and it's fun, to fight for your rights. We won't always win, but you can only win by fighting back. And even when we don't win, we have the pride of having fought a good battle. Mm-hmm. And that's a hell of a lot better feeling than thinking that you slunk away. Mm-hmm. So get this book and read it. You'll be glad you did.
The wonderful Megan Cornish. Why? Because we were there and we continue to be our sheroes fighting the good fight against life-threatening sexism, against racism, against homophobic responses, xenophobia, and now the pied de resistance of our May Day special. We're going straight to the streets of Venezuela to tell it like it is and correct all the erroneous misrepresentation, the lies, the deceits of imperial empire. You're going to hear in a moment, but let's warm up to go to May Day in Venezuela. To tell you, I hate fading that down and somebody saying, what? You're playing celebratory music? You're talking about, Chavez no se va. What's the matter with you? Don't you know that there's a coup being staged in Venezuela? Well, we're going to tell it like it is. We're going to find out the truth. And I have to say, in this, our final half hour of our May Day special with Ken Nash and Mimi Rosenberg, we're building bridges. Last night, I rushed up to Union Square when I heard there was a Venezuelan demonstration, assuming it was Chavez no se va, and support the Maduro administration, hands off Venezuela. And I got there, and there were about 20, 25 at most Guaido fans, staged as hell, but okay, they were there. I then came back and listened to the news reports, which made it sound like there were thousands of people who were saying yes to the elected government of Guaido against the greatest cartel bringing drugs into the U.S. and Great Britain, the Maduro administration. Well, here to tell it like it is Brother William Camacaro, who is with La Voz Latino and has been an activist for the rights of the people and the people of Venezuela for as long can be. Brother William, how do you fare? What's really happening in Venezuela, my brother?
Thank you very much for having me, Mimi. Wonderful presentation. Let me tell you, yes, we have been here in Venezuela for a few days already. We have a group of people from the United States that came in solidarity with Venezuela. And basically, yesterday what happened was something that is a fiction. To be some kind of, you know, someone could be writing something, a fiction book with what happened yesterday. It's basically these right-wing people, they took several very young soldiers, people around 18, 20 years old. They lied to them. They told them that they will be condecorated, and they take them to this area to supposedly condecorate. And then what happened is that Guaido was there with all these right-wing people just to use the images during his speech that he made yesterday to try basically to call the militaries into trying to see if something happened in the militaries, and people start to go to the street to protest against the government. It's not everybody knows that Venezuela is facing an economic crisis thanks to the sanctions imposed by the United States. In beginning with the Obama administration, it is the infamous decree declaring Venezuela an unusual and extraordinary threat to the security of the United States. Thanks to that decree, Donald Trump has been able to pass numbers of sanctions that have been destroying the economy of Venezuela. So basically, through that circumstance, they were hoping to mobilize people against the government and also to mobilize the army. So this was just a show. What happened yesterday was a media show that was the, we are talking about maybe 200 people were in the street yesterday demonstrating with Mr. Guaido, and the mainstream media international is talking about thousands of people, but no. And they are showing also images that don't have to be anything to do with what happened to yesterday. And today we have, images of the demo that Guaido people has, and we can say that around 3,000 people were there. If we want to be generous, maybe 4,000, no more, people were demonstrating in support of Guaido. But in the case of the government of Venezuela, hundreds of thousands of people were on the street. And it was impressive to see the images and the videos of thousands and thousands of people demonstrating in support of Maduro, but also again, the USA intervention and the USA military invasion, and again, the imperialism and capitalism. Let's put it this way. We are facing economic crisis in Venezuela, and people are mobilizing not just to support Maduro. I will say more to defend their sovereignty, to defend their revolution, to defend their right to do what they want to do with the country, with their country. So that's why people are in the street. This is not a revolution because belong is something that is attached to a person. No, it's something that belongs to the people. And it's the people that have been in the street demonstrating in support of Maduro because they know that Maduro right now represents the sovereignty and the freedom of the country. So it was incredible, really, to see thousands and thousands of people today gathering in support of the Venezuelan government.
William Kamakato, let me ask you this. How perilous do you think the situation is? The U.S. is definitely behind attacking the power grid. Tens of thousands of people's lives are in jeopardy because of the sanctions. They are attacking the Venezuelan embassy in Washington, which we'll find out about a little bit later in this half hour, and on and on and on. And, of course, literally mercenaries trying to foment armed struggle. And the threat still of bombing, not off the table. So, can you assess, really, how perilous it is and further tell us about who the hell Juan Guaido is, who the BBC and all the news media here are insisting is the valid, elected representative of the government? Who the hell is this man?
Well, basically, no one knew Guaido until this past January. Even people in Venezuela, they didn't know him. He was completely unknown. He became a celebrity as the day that he decided to proclaim himself the Venezuelan president with the support of the United States. It's a fabrication of United States agencies. Basically, he was a student in Georgetown University, and for two years, he was very well connected with some people working with CIA in the United States. So he's doing his job. He was contacted for this kind of stuff. He is just a fabrication of the State Department. The thing is that he doesn't have any base. No one knows him. Even among the right wing, no one knows him. And that's one thing. But all these virulent attacks that is almost daily in every front against the government of Venezuela is an attack that that is connected to the reality that Venezuela was a country that during the Chavez administration opposed, again, the free trade agreement when George Bush Jr. was trying to implement the free trade agreement in the Americas. So we defeated the free trade agreement in Chile in Martha's Vineyard. But then Chavez, together with the UNASUR, the Union of South America Countries, that now is completely dismantled, opposed to the TPP during 8 years, almost 8 years, he was confronting Obama again and again, this free trade agreement that was the TPP, and Obama was unable to sign anything. And that's why it was too easy for Trump to drop from the TPP, because anything was signed. So, and that, at the end, gave an advantage to China, because China was able to build the so-called Belt of the Silk, or the Belt of the Silk, and they have been expanding the economy very quickly. And the United States doesn't have anything to compete with China in place. They don't have anything in place to compete. What I mean is, what I'm trying to say is that the corporate interest of the United States has been losing a lot of money thanks to the opposition, not American people. It's the corporate interest that is something else and not the interest of the American people. They don't have the interest of the American people. They have been losing a lot of money because they have not been able to do those free trade agreements, to implement those free trade agreements. And that's one of the reasons, because those attacks are coming against Venezuela. But the other reason is that Venezuela built all this multilateral organization, the UNASUR, that in a moment was confronting all the corporate interests in South America, the Union of South American Countries, then the CELAC, that was an organization, it's an organization, it still exists, that is formed by all Latin American countries except the United States and Canada. Then we have ALBA, Bolivia, Venezuela, Nicaragua, Cuba, and several islands in the Caribbean. So several islands are from the Caribbean Sea. And we have other, you know, and he started to open the door for China, Russia, India, and South Africa to invest in Latin America. So that's another problem for the United States, especially for the elite, for the corporate interest, because right now, one of the biggest investors in South America is China, not United States. And then we have the resources. Venezuela is a country that has a lot of resources. Not only is the first country to have the biggest reserve of oil, but also the second reserve in gold. Venezuela has the third reserve in gas. Venezuela has a huge reserve in diamonds, and also in uranium and coltan. Also, there is a strange mineral, radioactive mineral, that is going to replace uranium in the future, that is tudo. This mineral is already several nuclear plants that are using this mineral to produce electricity. And Venezuela has one of the biggest reserves and the planet of that mineral. So it is. There are so many issues, economic issues, political issues, that the elite, especially in the State Department and the Pentagon, they cannot forget what Chavez did, what Venezuela has been doing, and they cannot, and they are trying to really mobilize very quickly to destroy the Venezuelan economy, because they don't want Venezuela to stand by itself, because they know that Venezuela has enough resources to, you know, push the continent through the left again.
William, let me also ask you this. The ideology of the Chavez revolution that was started in Venezuela, which actually has been defended in places like Haiti, etc. But one of the interesting things about it, of course, we see the resurgence of the ultra-right, of really fascism, of a military fascism in the form of Bolsonaro in Brazil. We certainly see that in other places now in Latin America. And, of course, a worldwide resurgence from Italy to Austria to Poland, etc., of fascism. So how critical is it also also ideologically for the U.S. to try to install a puppet, a figure like Guaido, who comes out of its own creation, but certainly one to defeat the spirit, the energy, the ideology of the Bolivarian Revolution.
Yes, we can see, for example, the tendency in the entire continent that people, the countries like Brazil, that went to this extreme right with Bolsonaro, a fascist government, also the same thing in Colombia, that is, this is a government that is completely linked with the narco-traffic, and a government that is completely linked with the so-called falso positivo. I don't know how to say it in English, but all these people that disappeared, that were killed, and they said that they were guerrilla members. So it's very dangerous what's going on right now, because they really are moving the entire continent to the, not only to the right, to the extreme right, and to fascism. And we see this all over, and they see Venezuela as an obstacle to trying to implement the entire plan. They even talk. Just a few days ago, Bolton was saying that if they resolve the Venezuelan problem, they will be able to resolve two or three problems at the same time. So that's the main issue. They know that if they are able to display the Bolivarian Revolution from power, they will be able to attack easily Cuba, Nicaragua. Also, they will be easy to attack Bolivia, that is also in the eyes of the hurricane. They right now not attacking Bolivia directly, but it's the country that they are desperately also they wish to attack. So and what they really want is to implement the Monroe Doctrine in the entire continent and destroy the sovereignty of all those countries in South America, and they be able to get all those resources. And we really are in a very scary situation, not only because these crazy people that in my case, I believe that we have in the United States a pathology, a cabinet that completely they have a pathology, mental problems. I don't know. It's an incredible sick cabinet that we have in the United States right now. So anything can happen. If you see clearly what's happening in Minnesota, it's a confrontation between the new order that was mentioned by the Bush administration, and something new that's coming now. If Venezuela is able to succeed, what's going to happen is that the relation with the United States is going to change completely. The relation with Europe is going to change, and the relation with the South is going to change, because it's a confrontation between those superpowers, China, Russia, India, and all other countries, Iran, South Africa, that they have also interest in the international market. And then you have this confrontation with all these superpowers and all these countries from the South that they want to be represented, and they want to be respected. They want to have a say to do the best for their people, for their country. So this is a confrontation that can take you to another war, third war. And we are very close to something like that. So, and people don't see that in the United States. I don't think that people are thinking that this is something, it's just Venezuela. No, we are very close to an international confrontation, military international confrontation, where Russia, China, and all the superpowers will be, the United States will be, and all the superpowers will be involved. And that's because, again, it's not because human rights, it's not because, they want to defend the poor Venezuela. It's because money, it's because resources, it's because exploitation. They want to get everything.
And let me also tell... let me just interrupt you to tell our listeners that we are speaking with William Camacaro from the streets of Venezuela, who has been there, who is telling it like it is and setting the record straight. And William, in the time that we have left, again, for people who say, but look at the images I've seen on TV. Look at the barrage of things that are being said on all news media. And look, of course, the flip side of this, what's not being said on the so-called liberal refugees from The Nation magazine, who are now the prime hosts on MSNBC, Rachel Maddow and Chris Hayes. Not a blooming word. Well, we know that we have to lift the sanctions, but in the time that we have left, Brother William Camacaro, tell us what we need to do to make it clear, hands off Venezuela, and of course, where is the heart and soul of the people now of Venezuela? With Guaido or with the Maduro or the idea of the Bolivarian revolution?
I think there definitely are no Guaido. People are very, very, they really support the Bolivarian revolution. You have to, for those that have been listening for more than a decade, that all the lies from the mainstream media against Venezuela, all the sabotage and the economic sabotage and all the stuff that has been happening thanks to the United States support, you need to understand that something strong is happening here, that they have not been able to remove this government from power. Something strong is happening here, that despite all this lack that they have been expressed all over the planet, they have not been able to remove this revolution from, and it's because people really support this. And then it's because there are so many, the base is poor people of Venezuela and the majority of poor. And they want to change. And they want to be back, to have access of their own country. And they want to improve. They want to improve the style of life. And that's what's important. But I think it's different because they have
William, you're breaking up just a little bit. Maybe let's try that again. And we have 3-4 more minutes. And I want you to know how special it is, still, the courage and the energy, because we take nothing for granted of our brother William Camacaro in Venezuela. His people, his report to us, you're getting it here. This is the exclusive, the reality of what's going on, the people's story. And we want to we have to finish up to make way for our 8 o'clock program. But I want you to know this is why we support WBAI. This is why BAI absolutely, the hell with whatever premium or anything. The premium is the airwaves, the truth to power that we speak. And more than that, being an advocate for people's power and towards a socialist revolution. Nothing other than that on May Day. So if you can perhaps take us out on Venezuelan May Day and what we have to do, again, to support sovereignty for the Venezuelan people and support, yes, the Maduro administration and the Bolivarian revolution.
Yes, I think that definitely for all the American people, one of the best things that they can do is to support Venezuela. Because, first of all, Venezuela has been struggling against the free trade agreement, as I mentioned, an agreement that is not only screwing our lives in America, but also here in the South, but also because we are looking for a new world is possible. And that's something that we all over want. We want really to have access to medicine, to have access to education, to have access to another kind of life. And the United States is pushing this country and all this, but basically, I have a lot of noise here, interruption, but basically, I believe for people in America and the United States, it's very important to go out to the streets to request no USA intervention, basically, no USA intervention, no sanctions in Venezuela. People in Venezuela are suffering already. General Cabello, you mentioned that more than 40,000 Venezuelans have been dying because of the sanctions, because they didn't have the medical stuff on time. Already people are suffering. So we need people in the United States to understand that those sanctions are killing, and that is a human right violation, and that those people that are implementing those sanctions are committing a crime, and a crime, humanity crime, against the Venezuelan people. And that's the most important thing. We don't want war in Venezuela. We don't want a war in Venezuela. We don't want sanctions for the Venezuelan people, as well as we don't want sanctions for any country on the planet.
Well, William Camacado, thank you for being with us, for giving us those reports. The people clearly in Venezuela, the people are amazingly calm and incredibly resilient despite the sanctions and constant threat of military intervention. The U.S. does not seem to understand the pulse of the street, nor does it understand the history of the Venezuelan military. Thank you for highlighting all of these issues. We want you to stay safe. William has also led a whole delegation of people to Venezuela. We're going to find out more when they return. Again, be safe, be safe, be safe. We put nothing past the U.S. Thank you for your courage. Thank you for educating us against U.S. empire. And we have been speaking to the wonderful William Camacado, who you can hear regularly on our airways on WBAI on La Voz Latina. And brother, good May Day, and we'll stay in close touch. And as my brother Bernard White used to say, and we will pay close attention. U.S., damn you, hands off Venezuela.
Thank you very much, Amy.
Okay. Well, despite the fact I'm not Amy, William, shame on you. You knew that. But she is my evil twin. We do think alike. And, of course, he's referring to the great Amy Goodman. I'm honored to have been inadvertently called Amy. I am Mimi Rosenberg.
The great Mimi Rosenberg.
I wouldn't go that far at all.
I would go that far.
Well, that's very considerate, and that is the great, the wonderful champion of the working class for decades and decades and decades. My wonderful co-host who prepared this extraordinary May Day celebration for all of you. We are building bridges, and I will join you tomorrow morning for Equal Rights and Justice at 9 a.m. And sisters and brothers, I'm sorry, we got seconds left. You got to support WBAI. You got it. Call 516-620-3602. Make a pledge, because this is the kind of, we are partisan. We are for the working class, against racism, against homophobism, against xenophobism. We are for the working class. We are against racism. We are for power to the people. Onward to socialism. I'm Mimi Rosenberg.
Happy May Day, happy May Day, happy May Day.
Because you have workers of the world unite.
You have nothing to lose but your chains, and you have a world to win.
Indeed we do. Reggie, our fabulous engineer,
thank you
for tolerating us throughout the whole day. You see, there's work that goes into doing this. Support WBAI 99.5 FM. Good May Day to all of you. Onward, upward, forward ever, backwards, never.
Good night.
Still speaks French, though.
If I had a hammer, I'd hammer it tomorrow, hammer in the evening.
Friday, May 3rd, is the 100th anniversary of the birth of the legendary musician and activist Pete Seeger. Pete had a rich history over the years with WBAI, among many organizations. And we will celebrate his life on that day with special programming from 9 a.m. till midnight. Programs with him from our archives and others, ranging from the early 60s to 2013. Conversations with people who had connections to him and lots of his music and wisdom. If you're a Pete fan or want to know more about him, you won't want to miss it. So once again, Friday, May 3rd, a celebration of Pete Seeger here on WBAI from 9 a.m. till midnight.
If you are a Gary Noe fan, stay tuned, because we're going to hear more from Gary Noe. He is going to be talking about a plan that he has to increase the longevity of each person who goes along with a change in lifestyle. We are listener-sponsored, non-commercial WBAI in New York. And for those of you who have become members of WBAI because you know that WBAI is important to your life, because you enjoy listening to WBAI maybe 5 hours a week, or maybe 10 hours a week, or maybe more, because you know that WBAI means something for you, that it helps you, that it creates a situation in your life where you are thinking about things that maybe you hadn't thought about before. And if that's the case, then we're hoping that you become a member of WBAI by calling 516-620-3602, by becoming a listener sponsor to WBAI. Go to our website, give2wbai.org, and become a member. We are going to be talking about how to live forever in terms of what Gary Null is going to talk to us about. I guess it's not really living forever, but it is increasing your lifespan by changing certain protocols. So we're going to be talking about that with Gary in just a little while. And we are going to be offering an incentive for you to become a member of listener-sponsored WBAI. And the incentive is going to be an ultimate anti-aging formula capsule that he's going to be presenting to us, which we are offering to you for $99. And with that, he's throwing in a DVD, and he's going to tell you about that DVD. So let's hear first a little bit about the reasons that Gary is telling us we can live longer than we think that we can.
I'm going to show you something of where disease starts. Why do we get old? Myth number one. The basic four food group will not keep you healthy. It will cause disease. It is the primary cause of disease. Human disease is caused by many of these foods. Sugar's at the top of the list. Get the sugar out. If sugar were invented today for the first time, it'd be banned as a toxin, as a poison. It would never be allowed into our system. This is what goes into the average person. A lot of it's disguised. You'll see the word glucose, corn syrup. Well, grape sugar, it's all sugar. And all of it is bad for your system. It feeds yeast, it feeds bacteria, it lowers immune response. This is how much sugar the average American has each day.
And that's Gary Null speaking about how you can change your life if you change your diet. But that's not the clip that I wanted to play. Can you please play that first clip for us, Reggie, which is the introduction of Gary's film that we're going to be talking about in a little while.
What if I told you that 70 years? What if I told you that 70 years is half of what you should be living? What if I told you that we could reverse however old you are now? So you're 50? What if by following a simple program, an easy program, a program that is absolutely capable of being followed by everyone watching right now, that I could knock in 2 years, if you followed, I could knock 5 years of your biological age off? What if you're 70 and we could make you 60? What if you're 80 and we could make you 70? And not just that, what if the diseases of arthritis, heart disease, dementia, forgetfulness, fatigue, what if we could eliminate those completely? Now, I'm not promising you can live indefinitely. That would be false. But I am promising you that we have the knowledge, we have the science, we have the wherewithal to stop disease. That I will promise you today. You do not have to be sick. And if your doctor or anyone else tells you that, well, your heart disease is inevitable, high cholesterol is inevitable, they are wrong. We are at the threshold. We have the knowledge to reinvent the genetic sequencing within our body, and we have done it. Many of you have done it naturally. And by the way, that should make people wake up and pay attention, because in this program today, you're going to find out how some of you have given up your medications, reversed your aging process, and done it with ease.
This is listener-sponsored WBAI in New York. Gary, are you with us?
I sure am. Thank you very much for inviting me, Linda.
Oh, hi, Gary. So are you in Texas?
Yes, I am. I'm with WBAI listeners, and they are losing weight, overcoming depression and anxiety. People are walking who hadn't walked in a long time. This morning I took them on a bucolic walk. They walked for about 3 miles. One woman hadn't walked 50 feet, she said, in the last 5 years because she had so much pain in her ankles and so much pain in her back. Now she doesn't have any of that pain. So this is only the third day, and so we're expecting some remarkable changes by the end of this week. So I'm happy to be here and happy to be raising money for the station.
Thank you so much. So wait, let's just talk about this woman. So this woman was not able to walk 3 days ago as comfortably as today?
Well, in point of fact, she had a cane when she got out of the van from the airport, and she sat down. And then the first day, when everybody else was learning how to stretch and loosen their muscles, and we just want to take them on a little walk, and she just was sitting there. I said, aren't you joining us? She said, oh, I can't. She said, I haven't walked in, goodness, 5 years. And I said, why not? She said, well, I've got pain in my knees. And what's your doctor say? Well, it's inevitable. I'm 68 years old. And I said, you're not even middle-aged yet, biologically. And she said, really? I said, yes. And she said, why my doctor? I said, well, maybe your doctor is good at what he or she does, but it's what they don't know they can't help you with. And I said, so I look at health from a different paradigm. And so I gave her some teas to drink, and I got her special juices that are very alkaline, like lemon, ginger, lemongrass, and also manuka honey, apple, green apple, celery, and cucumber. And after she started drinking those, and she hadn't drank a juice, she did drink sodas. Interesting, she was drinking 4 sodas a day, and her doctor didn't mention anything about that. She would snack on jelly beans all day long, she said. The doctor didn't mention anything about that. Uh-huh. I said, well, how many jelly beans do you eat? She said, well, I generally get once a week, I get a big package, and by the end of the week, I've eaten it all. So her diet was just, it was a terrible diet. It was high in acrylamides, which are brown foods, like a bagel, a potato chip, a pretzel, toast, pizza crust. And so I said, you know, that's a pro-inflammatory substance that you're taking in, a chemical that's made in the dough of the food when it's heated to high temperature. So just by cleansing, on a cleansing diet, rich in sunflower sprouts, fenugreek, clover, garlic, and chives, and she had a whole bowl of that, and she said, what am I supposed to do? I said, you're supposed to eat it. She said, well, I've never eaten anything like this. What is it? I said, these are sprouts. Could you imagine if someone had never seen a sprout?
Mm-hmm.
And they're 68 years old?
Right.
And so then I did a class on how to sprout yesterday afternoon at 4 o'clock. Did an hour class showing how inexpensive it is. They can do it in their own apartment. They can do it on their countertop. And there's more nutrients in sprouts than in a full-grown vegetable.
Aren't we having, isn't there going to be another retreat later on? You know, I know people listening are thinking, oh, my goodness, I wish I was there. Isn't there going to be another retreat?
Well, there's another retreat starting this coming Sunday. This is 2 weeks. So, you know, one group's leaving on Saturday, and another group's coming on Sunday. And for the foreseeable future, that's it. A lot of effort.
I mean, it's a lot of work.
1,400 hours.
Yeah. Do you do some of the cooking? I heard that you some of the cooking. Yeah.
I brought in 2 of the best chefs I could in America, and plus a sous chef and a master chef. In fact, our master chef came from New Orleans, where he's working in a television series, Brian Grazer television series, and he took time off. Now, that cost him. He wasn't paid for, you know, the high dollars that, you know, I can't afford that. I pay him, but not that amount of money.
Nice.
You get in a Hollywood set, but he came up here because he's a vegan, and he loves seeing transformation in people.
Mm-hmm.
So he did, and then I go in and I created all the menus, and they're all gourmet vegan. They're beautifully presented. They're presented like a French cooking, one dish at a time, and we eat in silence so people can really take their time and masticate their food and get good digestion. Then we go out after we eat for a light little walk to stimulate our digestive fluids and help us with digestion. And then we have lectures. I've done, in 3 days, I've done 23 hours in lectures. 23 hours, about 7 hours of lecturing a day. And so whatever I see they need, these are all extemporaneous. I give them the best input I can. And more than anything, it's wonderful human beings who have not actualized their own authentic life. They live through other people's expectations. And I'm going to suggest the average age. There's a spectrum. We have some people in their 30s and people in their 80s. One gentleman who's 96. Now, the guy who's 96 is interesting because a year ago he came here. And he's an engineer. And he's been married to the same woman for 57 years. And